Central Time, I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin saw protests across the state this weekend after the death of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who died while handcuffed by the Minneapolis police. We'll talk to journalists in four different parts of Wisconsin about what they saw and what happens next. First, as nonviolent and violent protests have been going on in the state and around the country, members of the media have been trying to cover the rapidly evolving events. And some journalism experts say the way that the media frames the protest story can do a lot to shape public opinion. Some elected officials and others are making the same case. Here's Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway speaking Sunday after a night in the city that included standoffs with law enforcement, vandalism, looting, fires, and tear gas.
I want to thank Freedom Inc. and Urban Triage for organizing a successful, justified, and peaceful protest yesterday. And I want to make sure that everyone in the media and everyone in our community understands that this was not a case of a protest turning violent. This was a case of a protest successfully concluding peacefully, and then a relatively small group of people coming in to cause violence and property damage.
Mike Wagner is a UW-Madison professor of journalism and mass communication. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, a lot of times I think the easy headline is protest turns violent or protest leads to violence, things like that. From what you heard from the Madison mayor there, can you talk about how the media can talk about both stories without necessarily implying they're necessarily the same story?
Yeah, it's a complicated thing to do because usually reporters are trying to tell a story about one thing. And here, as the mayor pointed out, there was more than one thing to talk about. There was a peaceful protest that was planned. It started. It ended. There was no destruction of property or anything like that. There was just a protest over an issue that is causing protests all around the country and indeed the globe. And then later, there were people who engaged in destruction of property and some violence as well. And so making sure that reporters can accurately reflect what's happening is really important when it comes to how people view the legitimacy of protests. Typically, news media kind of focus on what we think of as a protest paradigm, emphasizing drama, disruption, demands of grievances, and violence. And they kind of spend less time talking about what specific reasons people are protesting for in the first place.
How can people in the media try to sort all that out? It is not a very easy story to tell, given that, with 100 people, say, at a rally, there might be 100 different motivations for why they're there.
That's right. And, it's hard to cover an event in real time because the reporter's vantage point is limited to what they see when they may not see the whole thing. And I think we've seen that in the live television coverage that's been happening in Madison over the last few days, where some reporters are close to, say, a burning dumpster or a burning squad car, and other reporters are around folks who are generally quiet and, maybe articulating some grievances, but, not doing so with any destruction of property. And so it's difficult to tell these stories. And I think one thing that journalists can do is try to interview as many people who are a part of the protest as possible, especially when it comes to protests related to race. Research has shown that protesters get the least amount of quotes in stories that are about racially motivated protests or protests related to racial discrimination or inequity, whereas protesters for other issues get lots more attention. Usually it's public officials and police and chief executives like mayors or governors that get quoted in protests about race and not the people who are doing the protesting.
You had shared something, research on Twitter, an essay by a colleague of yours talking about how initial media reports can shape the public perception of a protest. How important do you think that is?
I think it's really important. If the focus of the coverage is on what the grievances are of the protesters and what caused those grievances, people are more likely to take those seriously than if the coverage is on disruptive behavior, the police use of violence, the threat of violence, video of militarized, Humvees rolling in and riot gear from police. So depending upon whether the focus of the coverage is on the spectacle, the potential for violence, or what the grievances are of the protesters goes a long way to shaping how people think about the protest in the first place and how they think about the issues that people are protesting about in the first place.
We're talking about media coverage of this weekend's protests. Mike Wagner is with us, UW-Madison Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication. Let's talk a little bit about putting things in context, Mike. I mean, a daily news report is usually trying to give you the who, what, when, where, why. And that why can be a little difficult. If you start digging in, you might want to go back 2 years or 200 years. How much can we successfully convey as we're trying to also recap what just happened?
That's another big challenge of reporting a live protest event, is that there is the new thing that's happening now, which is a protest. It's a mass gathering of people making some kind of demand or expressing dissatisfaction with something that's happening. And then there's the set of contextual reporting that journalists can engage in to tell us why this is occurring. Journalists can talk to experts about why that's happening. They can talk to the organizers of the protests, if the protest has organizers, and they can talk to the people doing the protesting to help try to understand what the motivations are. And in some cases, they'll learn that there are as many motivations for the protest as there are people out protesting. And in others, they'll learn that there's a fairly unified message about why people are out there and what it is they would like to see happen. And that's complicated. And it's a moving target. It's not something I think that a journalist can expect to get exactly right in just one story, but it's more of how the work progresses over a series of stories about that particular protest or set of protests that they're trying to cover.
An additional challenge here, Mike, is that this is coming in a time where we've seen years of cutbacks and layoffs in newsrooms. A big company might buy out a newspaper and cut back staff. And now on top of that, furloughs related to financial difficulties from COVID-19. These are news units, in many cases anyway, at the local level that are stretched thin, if they're there at all.
That's absolutely true. And that causes a few problems, right? One problem is that a lot of the institutional memory of a news organization gets gutted when people are furloughed or take voluntary buyouts and things like that. And this is when you see the hiring then of someone much newer and cheaper and not from here, with the experience of having lived, here, if we're talking about the protests in Madison, for example, as a way to help build trust with the audience. And so I noticed last night, I was kind of flipping between a lot of the major television stations in town, and one of the new reporters noted that they were next to Ian's Pizza, right, instead of Ian's, right? So it's just those kinds of things where you haven't lived here, and so you don't know exactly, what businesses are called, who the key players are on major issues, what the history is on any particular issue, especially one that sparks a protest. And it makes it harder to build trust with the audience. And a lot of that comes from what we see when newsrooms are forced to shrink because of the budgetary environment that news organizations find them in. And so it makes it harder to report accurately. It makes it harder to build trust with the audience, which then makes it harder for the news organizations to make the money they need to make to have a more robust set of reporters out there doing their work.
Another difficulty, we've seen journalists attacked in some cases by protesters, in some cases by police, or even, as in this example, arrested. CNN's Omar Jimenez was actually arrested live on the air while his four-person production team was trying to report on street closures in Minneapolis. Here's a listen to some of that scene.
I'm sorry?
You're under arrest.
Okay. Do you mind telling me why I'm under arrest, sir?
Why am I under arrest, sir?
Officer, you're with CNN and he's on the air right now.
Okay.
You are arresting him live on CNN. We told you before that we are with CNN.
If you're just tuning in, you are watching our correspondent, Omar Jimenez, being arrested by state police in Minnesota. We're not sure why our correspondent is being arrested.
So, Mike, how reporters, correspondents have been treated over the course of their coverage of this protest?
As is often the case during protests like these, especially ones related to anti-Black racism, reporters are getting arrested or shot at. So Omar Jimenez of CNN, as you noted, was arrested. Other reporters have been arrested. Caitlin Rust in Louisville got shot at live on the air with pepper balls. And then when the camera operator that she was working with was saying to police that they were news media, one of their police officers turned their gun on the camera operator and started shooting at them. And so this is not new. Nearly a dozen reporters, at least, were arrested during the Ferguson protests a few years ago in Missouri. This happens regularly and is a way to prevent news organizations from engaging in their First Amendment right and their civic obligation to report to the public on what is happening in events like these.
We're talking to UW-Madison Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication Mike Wagner about media coverage of this weekend's protest, violence and destruction, and peaceful rallies as well, associated with the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis a week ago. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you been following reporting on these protests? When something like this is going on, what do you want from the media, whether it's print or broadcast or online? What bugs you about the way these things are covered? If you've been on hand at a scene, what have you seen from the coverage? Did it match up with the reality you saw? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with UW-Madison journalism professor Mike Wagner about what the media might be getting right and wrong in the way it covers protests and demonstrations following the death of George Floyd. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What different news sources are you turning to for coverage of the protests and demonstrations? What similarities, what differences are you seeing? What do you want to see from the media as they cover an event like this? What do you worry that might be missed in the stories we tell? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mike, before we go to our callers, I want to get your thoughts on how the media can deal with rumors. In this case, we have, as with any protest, rumors, the left Antifa or anarchist groups are participating in hijacking, others pointing toward right-wing infiltrators. We've heard this from people at various levels of government, too. And, of course, with the Internet, these rumors fly around really quickly. How can the media try to tackle that in a way, given that a lot of sides have a stake in their rumors being right, I guess?
Right. I think the most important thing is transparency. So reporters need to first think carefully about who are the sources for these claims, right? If it's a governor or a mayor, as has been the case in Minneapolis, for example, talking about some claims that people are coming from the outside, reporting those claims, reporting the sources of those claims, and then reporting any relevant context, right? Is there, for example, as there is when we talk about what are often referred to as outside agitators, is there a history of officials reporting or using that as a way to try to discredit the motives of the people doing the protest? Or is it trying to put into context the differences between the peaceful protest, for example, that happened in Minneapolis and then and other places like Madison, and then violent or property destruction outbursts in most cases that took place after the protests, especially the one in Madison, now had ended? And so transparency of sources is the most important thing, not reporting rumors where a trusted source is not involved is another. And when beating down rumors, the research shows the best thing to do is report what's true rather than say this thing is not true. People tend to have a harder time remembering where they learn stuff and have a, because they're consuming media while doing other things, right? They're driving their car, they're, you know, wrangling their kids, they're cooking dinner, and so it's more effective for reporters to say these are the things that are true, rather than say a bunch of things that are false and then say, oh, and those were debunked. It's just harder for people to get that stuff right when they're trying to remember what they learned from the news.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, interesting topic. I feel and I believe that this is a time for journalism to take a step back. We have had fake news in our country, and I believe that journalists are too close to the action, and I think they want to be because they're trying to get the story, but I think they're putting themselves in harm's way unnecessarily, and I question the judgment of the bosses of these companies telling these young people, these young journalists, to get between yourself and the police and the demonstrators and try to see both. When the police are trying to take control of the situation, I have a respect for authority. When the police are in a situation, I respect their authority. I keep my distance. I've been racially profiled as a white person in the south side of Chicago in a black community. I know how it feels to be singled out because of your race. I learned to keep my distance.
Thanks for the call. Jeff saying journalists are putting themselves at risk unnecessarily by getting too close to the action.
Journalism is a risky job. Many journalists get killed every year doing their work. Journalists, as we've seen in the last couple of days, get shot at, get arrested, and worse. And so journalists tend to know that it's a risky job, and many, if not most, journalists prefer to chase the story and certainly tend to blanch or object when they're told by officials that they need to get out of the way. Journalists are there to document what's happening, and they're there to show us whether the people that we pay with our tax dollars are doing their jobs in ways that we want them done. And if journalists aren't there, then they can't do that documentation for us. The Constitution enshrines a right for journalists to be able to engage in coverage without the government preventing them from doing so. And it is a risk. There's no doubt about that. But as we see when, for example, the arrest of CNN's Omar Jimenez, he was more than willing to go where the police wanted him to go. He kept asking them, where would you like me to be? We'll go there. It's not that he wasn't listening to the directions of the police officers. It's that they arrested him anyway. And that's a fundamental difference that Americans should be forced to see and should be forced to reckon with.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We'll go to Owen in Wyoega now. Owen, hello.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys taking my call. Journalism, let's talk about it for a minute, because I don't agree that something about the pronunciation of a particular restaurant in an area of the city that would be technically important to the local folks is not going to make you a good journalist. Because if you are conveying your message to people that could be visitors to the area or anywhere else, they're not going to know the difference between that pronunciation and the other pronunciation. I believe that journalism needs to focus more on not the big players or the key players in a neighborhood or an area or the right way or the wrong way to say the name of a restaurant. I think they need to focus more on listening to all points of view and not just finding the people who have credentials, such as people who have been published or have some sort of authority in the community as being.
Thanks a lot for the call. You gave us a lot to work with already. The restaurant example, Mike, I think was just an example of the kind of local knowledge a reporter could bring to the table. But let's hit Owen's second point there. He wants to hear more from ordinary people in a story like this, it sounds like.
Well, the research on protests would suggest that that's just what's not happening, especially in protests that are about issues related to race and racism. Usually what we hear from there are people who are elected officials or people who are working with and for some aspect of the government. And we tend not to hear in news coverage from people. And that's one thing I think a lot of media critics and protesters are pushing back at and would prefer the voices of those who are trying to share their grievance with their government and with their community, have them have a chance to be heard.
Thanks a lot for the call, Owen. Mike, let's talk about something you were touching on earlier, how much you want to capture the drama of a situation. Is there something inherently more vivid and eye-catching that's always going to grab media attention about, say, a block of a city that's on fire as opposed to a block of a city that's hosting a peaceful prayer vigil?
Absolutely. The fire is going to be the video almost every time. The kind of spectacle opportunities are just more likely to get covered, and sometimes for good reason, right? It could be that the fire is a public safety risk, mm-hmm. and people need to know about that. But there are other times, if a small trash can is burning some cardboard, and there are other people who are trying to articulate why protesters are there and what protesters would like, it would be probably better for the for democratic deliberation to hear from the protesters rather than see the video. But that's a difficult judgment to make in live news coverage of a protest, which is also the other thing to remember here is that a lot of this stuff is always taking place live and isn't something that's carefully planned and vetted and edited and re-edited. It's happening in real time, which makes it all the more challenging.
And Mike, how does a medium like Twitter, where a lot of journalists, as they're covering, are also sharing events in real time, how does that shake things up?
Well, it shakes things up because it gives us a chance to talk back to the journalists, right? It gives us a chance to, in real time, criticize what they're doing, praise what they're doing, ask them questions, and also to share our own information. And that's where things get really dangerous for reporters, when they see a tweet and then have to decide, do I treat that tweet as news and report it, even though I might not be able to verify it? Or how do I treat a person's tweet if they're taking video or sharing video? A lot of tweets out there that have been shared claiming to be a video of a building on fire or something are from years ago. And others that are being shared are absolutely true representations of what's happening now. And it's really hard to make those judgments in real time to know what things to share and what not. And it just highlights the importance of the editing process and fact checking.
Mike, thanks again for joining us today.
Sure thing.
That's Mike Wagner, professor of journalism and mass communication at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about the challenges and opportunities for news media coverage of protests, specifically looking at the events this weekend surrounding the death of George Floyd. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to journalists across the state about the protests in Wisconsin this weekend. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. One of the groups leading cleanup efforts after this weekend's protests and looting in downtown Madison is the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County. Coming up, we talk to President and CEO Michael Johnson about the violence, racism in the community, and how to prevent more unrest. First, protests continued across Wisconsin over the weekend and around the country after the death of George Floyd. For the next half hour, we're going to talk to journalists who are on the ground covering the protests this weekend, starting with a look at what happened in Madison. Bridget Bowden is WPR Special Projects reporter. She was out Saturday reporting on the protests. Bridget, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it sounds in some ways, Bridget, like there were almost two protests. Can you start us off with the daytime protests on Saturday?
Definitely. That's definitely how I would describe it. So the first protest was a planned demonstration that started about noon at the Capitol, and it was attended by a lot of people. The estimate was about 2,000 people showed up for that. And it was a march. The group marched from the Capitol on to the Dane County Jail, and then on to the house on Williamson Street, where Tony Robinson, a Black teenager, was shot by a Madison police officer in 2015. And then they marched back to the Capitol. So that happened during the day.
And you spoke to protesters, some of them, about why they were out on Saturday. Here's what one of them, Kendra Odell, had to say.
We're trying to make a statement that we as citizens of this country in Madison will not stand for police brutality or racism, and we are here to protest all of the violence that has occurred in this country towards people of color.
What else did you hear from some of the protesters who were out during the daytime on Saturday, Bridget?
Right. So I think that the most important thing that I heard from protesters had actually to do, in addition to, you know, a racial justice, also that the COVID-19 pandemic, because the organizers of the march were very adamant that everyone wear masks. I saw volunteers handing out masks. And I talked to some protesters about why they felt it was important to come out and, you know, be part of a crowd of 2,000 people at a time when, you know, we're supposed to be socially distant. And the overwhelming answer that I got to that question was just that they feel like this is an important moment. It's an important thing for them to fight for. So to most of the protesters I talked to, it was worth the risk to stand up for what they believe in.
And then that protest, as you're saying, wound down, right?
For the most part, yes. Like, as I said, they marched back to the Capitol, at which point it started to disperse. I actually went home and filed my first story, thinking that the day's activities were through.
And then what happened as the evening started to continue on?
So there were still people who remained in the Capitol and State Street area. I wasn't there to see when this started, so I can't necessarily tell you what happened first or anything like that. But at some point, people who were gathered on State Street began smashing in windows on State Street. And at some point, police in riot gear came out and were using tear gas and pepper spray. And so protesters and police engaged in sort of a standoff throughout the night, throughout the State Street area. There was lots of tear gas that was deployed at various points. Lines of officers in riot gear blocked the cross streets of State Street at various points throughout the night. There was also pepper spray deployed. And then that gathering wound down about midnight.
And can you talk, as we wrap up, Bridget, about how city leaders responded to the events?
Right. So Madison Mayor Sasha Rose Conway had a press conference earlier in the evening where she had addressed the peaceful protest earlier in the day. And then later that night, after some of the more chaotic events had happened, she announced that there would be a curfew implemented. And so that curfew actually was in place last night. That's a curfew of 9:30 p.m.
Bridget, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's WPR's Bridget Bowden, based in Madison. Now we'll turn to protests in Appleton over the weekend. Natalie Brophy covers breaking news for the Appleton Post-Crescent. Natalie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, can you tell us some of what happened in these protests in Appleton this weekend?
Yeah, so on Saturday, there's a protest that started around 2 p.m. in downtown Appleton. I would say there's about 1,000 people there, and they marched from pretty much down College Avenue in the downtown area, and they got to Houdini Plaza in Appleton, and for about an hour and a half, you know, the crowd gathered, made some speeches, and people spoke, told their stories, shared, you know, their fears and worries about being Black in America. And, you know, the crowd there was very racially diverse, people of all ages. Some people had, you know, brought their children and that kind of stuff. And then after some of the speeches, the crowd made its way down to the police department, marched around the police department, and then up and down the avenue again, back to the plaza. And that's about when it ended, around 5 p.m. And I would say in comparison to, you know, some other protests in areas of the state and around the country, that, you know, the protest Saturday in Appleton was totally peaceful. There was no, you know, violence or looting, property destruction, no, you know, interaction with police. It was, you know, very peaceful protest.
And in an earlier piece, Natalie, you talked about the response to the incident in Minneapolis from Appleton's police chief. What kind of things did we hear?
Yeah, our police chief, he, you know, basically just expressed that he felt, you know, anger and fear and frustration when he saw what happened to George Floyd in Minneapolis, and that typically, as a police officer, he would not comment on something like that until, you know, all of the evidence was, you know, out there and everything was investigated. But basically, seeing what he saw in the video, he, you know, as a police officer, knew that, you know, that wasn't right, and that's not something an officer should have done. And he took the time to explain the Appleton Police Department's use of force policy, and what goes into that, and how officers who do use force are, you know, monitored, and how use of force incidents are reviewed in the city of Appleton. That was kind of his response to what had happened in Minneapolis.
And getting back to the protests in Appleton over the weekend, what did you hear from individual people who you talked to about why they had shown up this weekend?
Mm-hmm. You know, a response from a lot of people was just that they're scared and they're tired of seeing incidents like what happened with George Floyd and an innocent person being killed by a police officer. And that's not the kind of country they want to live in. And they, you know, they came out to hear other people's stories, to share their own stories, and, you know, to try to, you know, be a part of making a change.
And Natalie, before we let you go, I know in some cities protests are ongoing day by day, or maybe they're planning ones week to week. Do you know of any future plans for protests in the Appleton area?
Yes, I believe there is one tonight, this afternoon around 5 p.m. In the downtown area. I don't have too many details about that, but I believe tonight at 5 p.m. there's something else planned.
Natalie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thank you so much.
That's Natalie Brophy with the Appleton Post-Crescent. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about protests across Wisconsin this weekend with a look at events in Duluth and in Milwaukee. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about protests this weekend around Wisconsin over the death of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who died after a Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Robin Washington joins us now. He's host of WPR's weekly Simply Superior program. He was out covering the protest in Duluth on Saturday. Robin, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're quite welcome, Rob.
What did we see in these protests in the Twin Ports over the weekend?
We saw about 1,000 people, which in the Twin Ports is a pretty big deal. Usually it's in the hundreds or so. And in fact, the interesting point is they were also very, from observation anyway, young people. I would say 80%, at least 75% of the crowd was under 40. So that's a bit different than what we're used to.
What kind of things did you hear from people at the protest?
Very strong statements, outrage. There were Kim Young of Superior, who was there, put it as, we are no longer asking, we are no longer begging, you know, we are demanding. But that being said, they were very strong, very inspirational. No real specifics, but just like to say that the police brutality against African Americans has to stop, period.
Let's give a listen to Kim Young at the rally, an elder from the group called the Superior African Heritage Community. Here's a listen.
Do black lives matter to you?
Yes!
Then you need to tear down the racist system that perpetuates the racism and systemic oppression.
And Robin, I understand there was maybe going to be a rally this month anyway. COVID-19 might have put a damper on it, but a commemoration of 100 years ago this month, a lynching that happened in Duluth back in 1920. Can you talk
right.
about that?
The triple lynching of Elias Clayton, Elmer Jackson, and Isaac McGee, three circus workers who were wrongly accused of raping a white woman and were lynched in Duluth on June 15th, 1920, the darkest moment in the city's history, really in the Twin Ports history, because it really defined the racial history of both cities since then. And so there was to be a commemoration calling for 10,000 people to come out to the site of the crime, which, by the way, now is a major memorial. Duluth is the only city that has a prominent memorial at the site of the crime of a lynching. 10,000 being the number of people who were there to perpetrate the crime. Obviously, that was called off. That would not quite be social distancing. But ironically, sadly ironically, this circumstance created another, I wouldn't say opportunity, but ended up being another sort of commemoration, if you will. And again, it started at the site, at the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial.
And was there any damage or any other of that kind of unrest that we've seen in some other cities around the country?
There was not the kind that we've seen in other cities, so that's the very good part about it. There was, after the protests, another group, or maybe the same group that moved very quickly, went to I-35 and blocked traffic for a while, but nothing serious happened that ended up dissipating. Later that night, there was a more serious incident at a Quick Trip gas station in West Duluth. There was a disturbance. An employee was, I understand from the police chief, Tuscan, substantially injured. Somebody has been arrested in that case. And last night, apparently, there were three dumpster fires. One interesting note about this, though, is that Chief Tuscan and Mayor Emily Larson both said that the perpetrators, or the people arrested, or the people responsible so far, or assumed to be responsible, are from this area, only one from Minneapolis. So that sort of goes against what you've been hearing in all kinds of places around the country where mayors and governors have said they're outsiders. In this case, Mayor Larson said, these are our people, and it means that we have to have more dialogue.
Robin, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
You're quite welcome.
That's WPR's Robin Washington, based in Superior. Now we'll turn to continued protests over the weekend in Milwaukee. Madeline Fox is a reporter for WPR based in Milwaukee. She covered the protests on Saturday. Maddie, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us some of what you saw on Saturday?
Well, we've had 3 days of protests so far in Milwaukee, and Saturday was, we actually had a little bit of an interesting Friday night, very early Saturday morning, where there were some property damage, and there were some arrests made after, I want to say in the wee hours of the morning. So then Saturday during the day, around the afternoon, I want to say it was around 1:30, there was a peaceful march that began in Veterans Park over on the lakefront. And that was marching for, gosh, I think 3 or 4 hours, some demonstrating in front of the police building downtown, a lot of chanting, as you would expect, a lot of cars honking in support, but very much a protest that was fairly, was pretty low key in terms of a protest. And the only thing that really got a little dicey was that police were definitely trying to keep protesters off the interstate, which it didn't lead to any major confrontations, but it was certainly... that would have been the most tense that I saw stuff get during the day on Saturday.
And I understand protesters connected the events in Minneapolis to officer-involved deaths in Milwaukee, a recent and further in the past. Can you talk about that?
That's right. So actually, I was at a protest Friday evening calling for justice in the case of Joel Acevedo, who was actually died from his injuries in April after he was restrained by an off-duty police officer named Michael Mattioli. During a party at Mattioli's house. Mattioli, the officer, has been charged with homicide and is on suspension, but Acevedo's family is asking for him to be fired, asking for him to be terminated from the police department, and they also want charges against two other people who were named as witnesses in the complaint that they believe were also involved in either helping Mattioli restrain Acevedo or not doing anything about it. And then there were also... There's a young man named Deontre Hamilton who died in Redfern Park, I believe, in Milwaukee in 2014. And so his name also came up during these protests.
I want to give a listen to someone you spoke to over the weekend, a protester named Josiah. Here's what he said.
I've been protesting since I started going to EWM 5 years ago, and I just graduated. And I'm still protesting, like, same different day, different year.
Did you hear that sense of frustration from a lot of the people there?
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly here in Milwaukee, but also I believe we're hearing it around the state and around the country that this is not a lot of people's first protest. They've been doing this for years, and they're getting really tired of not seeing meaningful changes and still seeing these deaths. I mean, to have a death in 2014 and then again just last month, people are really, 2 months ago now because it's June, people are really frustrated and just really exhausted and also feel like there's just a sense of powerlessness. And that's where I think this protest is coming from, that they're trying to make their voices heard because what they're seeing over and over, even with the protesting, is that things aren't changing.
Now, Lynn, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's WPR's Madeline Fox in Milwaukee. Finally, we'll hear about a prayer vigil that took place in Milwaukee yesterday. Corrine Hess is a reporter for WPR in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you tell us about this prayer protest in Milwaukee yesterday?
Yes, it was on the city's west side, and that's exactly what it was. It was a prayer protest is kind of a, not really even the right word.
Everybody vigil, was, I suppose, yeah.
I mean, they were calling it a protest, but it was very calm. There were about 300 people in a park that's right in the middle of the city. People were praying. There was a lot of songs sung. People were getting up and talking, but some of the speakers said that they were going to talk about times that they felt like they were the target of racism, either by police or others, but they actually didn't want to share that. They just wanted to talk about ways that that the community could be improved. So it was a lot different vibe than some of the other protests I had been to since Friday.
What were some of the things people either told you or spoke in front of people talking about ways to improve things?
Well, you know, I think I just heard Madeline talking. People are frustrated and they're sad that there hasn't been change over the years. The Don Perry Hamilton incident did take place 6 years ago. And we also had the Sherman Park riots just a few years ago. And just nothing really has changed here. It's probably gotten worse. So there was a lot of frustration and sadness. And, you know, over George Floyd in Minneapolis, but just over things that have been happening in the country overall.
And as you mentioned, this wasn't the kind of angry protest or vandalism that we've seen in some cases after peaceful protests have ended. Were people at this prayer vigil talking about some of those protests that appear to have gotten out of control?
You know, they weren't. I was asking a lot of people if they've gone to other protests, and they hadn't. This was the only one that a lot of them had gone to. But I was asking what they thought of the looting and some of the property destruction, and they said that they understood. They understood people's anger, and they also understood that this is all happening in the time of the coronavirus pandemic. People, especially people of color, have really been affected by the pandemic. And also, you know, there's been job loss. And I think that the people at this prayer vigil seemed to be very understanding of some of these protests getting out of control.
And as we wrap up, Corey, were there plans for more vigils like this one in the days and weeks to come?
You know, this wasn't the only one. There were other church groups that were holding marches and vigils. So I haven't seen any others planned, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were more.
Corey, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
That's WPR's Corrine Hess with us today to talk about prayer vigils held yesterday in Milwaukee. She rounded out our look at protests across Wisconsin this weekend, a wide variety, as we've heard, of people and places. Peaceful in some cases, less peaceful in others. You can follow the coverage from the WPR news team. They are continuing, I think as we speak, actually to cover protests happening in different places in the state. You can follow them, find them on Twitter, but a good place to start, of course, is WPR.org/news. You can find continuing coverage of the protests, of course, and everything going on in Wisconsin. Also, head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can see news updates there as well, and then join the conversation while you're there. if you have a personal experience of one of these protests as a protester, as a police officer, as a business person who's been affected by damage, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. We'll take a break from the big news for just a moment to talk about food. Last week on Food Friday, we talked about cooking with asparagus. We got a lot of great advice from our guest, and you shared your favorites, including a recipe that's going to be really hard to replicate at home. A great story from a caller who once had done a controlled prairie burn and afterward found a wild asparagus plant with the stalks cooked and ready to eat right where they stood. He ate them there in the prairie. Well, you kept sharing your favorite ways of preparing and, more importantly, eating asparagus on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amy says, toss with olive oil, salt, pepper, and garlic powder, and grill. That grill's going to be a lot more convenient than the controlled prairie burn, I think. Karen says, drizzle it with olive oil, sprinkle Parmesan cheese on it, and bake it in the oven. Katie says she likes it as individual spears wrapped in bacon, sautéed, and then seasoned with Himalayan sea salt and pepper. And then Joe says saute lightly with tarragon. And Tim just told us, I love asparagus. I'm right there with you, Tim. I made some in a pasta thing today. You can do a thing I found out on Friday where as you're finishing up the pasta, you dice up the asparagus, however thin you want it, let it boil for the last couple minutes. Almost overdid it, but not quite. It was still good. Keep sharing your favorite ways to cook asparagus on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.